And the wind shall say, here were decent, godless people. Their only monument, the asphalt road and a thousand lost golf balls.
From the NBC University Theater, a radio first, a dramatization of J.P. Marquand's latest novel, Point of No Return. Our star on this occasion, Mr. Kent Smith. For more than a decade now, J.P. Marquand has been writing some of America's most civilized novels, such estimable works as Wickford Point, The Late George Attlee, H.M. Pullum, Esquire, and B.F.'s Daughter. His latest book, Point of No Return, has been heading the bestseller lists for several months now. We're proud to bring it to you in a radio version by Milton Wayne. We bring you also an editorial comment on the writings of J.P. Marquand by one of America's most distinguished editors, Mr. Edward Weeks of the Atlantic Monthly. His commentary was recorded earlier and will be heard at the intermission. Today's adaptation of Point of No Return focuses on the contemporary aspects of the book and stars one of Hollywood's most mature performers, Mr. Kent Smith. Here then, Mr. Kent Smith as Charles Gray in Point of No Return.
Day begins at 7. Life begins. Life begins at 40, so they say. But what about 43, Mr. C? What happens to a man's life at 43? The life in question being that of myself, Charles Gray, husband, father, homeowner in Sycamore Park, Connecticut. Also one of the assistant vice presidents of the Stuyvesant Bank on Upper Fifth Avenue, New York City. I know what happens. And I don't like it a bit. I've been seeing it like a trailer for an unpleasant coming attraction. Nothing's changed yet. Probably won't till Friday. 4 days from now. 43 years against 4 days. Everything's still the same. But now, something up different. Because something different in me. I'm off my heels now, and all tiptoeing, uncertain as the pitch of a $10 trumpet. Charlie, my boy, let's face it square and say it right out to ourselves. We're afraid, suddenly. Suddenly, I'm afraid. Often that way before an unhappy thing. It's been a long and fairly merry flight, but now it's here. I've come to it. The point of no return.
Charlie, wake up.
Oh, I'm awake. Nancy? What's it doing out?
Raining.
Terrible morning, isn't it? I have a headache.
Oh, if you'd only remember not to drink after dinner.
Oh, I hate sitting around with a lot of people just talking after dinner.
Oh, darling, who was it who wanted to go to Clifford's?
Well, she gets me down, and I can't help feeling sorry for Brad.
Oh, everybody's always sorry for him. We should start feeling sorry for yourself.
I do. And right now.
And I wish you'd feel sorry for me.
I do. For you and for everybody else who lives in this bedroom town. And, in fact, for everyone else in the world. That's the way I feel right now.
Darling, don't be so broad-minded. You'll make me cry.
All right. All right.
And don't go to sleep again. Mm. I have to go down and cope with the coffee.
All right. Still raining?
Hard now. The windshield wipers on the car hardly ever work.
Well, that's swell. That makes it just swell. It's nice it's come to our attention.
I thought that might get you up. You'd better wear your herringbone suit. It's been cleaned. I put your discharge button on it.
Oh. Well, take it off, will you? I'm not running for any office.
Oh, yes, you are. Don't you keep forgetting it. You're right in there polishing apples. Hear me?
All right. Most of my life's been spent polishing some apple or other. If you have to earn your living, life's a series of apples. Oh, I guess I better get dressed.
Now, don't forget, wear the herringbone. And don't take that thing out of the buttonhole. No matter how well Roger Blakesley looks, he hasn't got a duck.
Nope, that's right. He was too bright to get one. And maybe he's just bright enough to get the vice presidency.
Which reminds me, we're going to the Burtons Friday night. Now, don't forget to tell Mr. Burton you're looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it, all right. I think it'll be D night.
What's that?
D, for decision.
Darling.
What?
You know, it's nice driving into the train again. It's sort of like coming back to where we started.
Yes, I know what you mean. It's funny, but when I came down to breakfast this morning, the whole place seemed ready-made.
Ready-made?
Yes. Just as though I'd never done anything about it.
Oh, I know. I'm too efficient.
That isn't what I mean.
Well, it's all right, as long as you don't mind. I wish I could stop coaching from the sidelines, but I can't help it, can I?
No. Of course you can.
You know, someday you're going to say you don't like it. I'm afraid of that. Darling, why don't you ask Tony Burton what the score is? Aren't you tired of waiting?
It'll get over. Everything does.
Well, if we just had the cards on the table, if you just said
so. Now, don't tell me what to say to him, because I'm not going to say anything.
Oh, I hope Roger Blakesley likes it. You know what Molly told me yesterday? She said, Roger's so glad you're back at the bank and settled down.
Well, that's swell. I just wish Roger'd get over acting as if I'd just gotten out of the service and was still adjusting. If the officers and directors want him for the job, they'll take him.
And you'll have to resign. Didn't Walter Gibbs once tell you, if they don't like you well enough to move you up, it's time to get out? You'll have to get out.
The next thing you'll be asking me to think of the children.
Well, what's so funny?
Not funny, just contrived. Like something out of Tennyson or a Victorian novel. The little woman kissing her husband goodbye. Everything depends on this moment. He must get the big job or Junior can't go to boarding school. And what about the payments and the new car? So goodbye, darling, and don't come back to me without being vice president of the trust company. That's all I mean.
Don't say that.
Why not?
Don't say it. Because maybe you're right.
No, wait.
Because if you say that, if you mean that, well, maybe it isn't much, but it's all we have. Maybe it isn't much, but then maybe we aren't much. And if you feel that way, why, there won't be anything anymore.
Listen, Nance. Let's not get so emotionally involved.
Involved with what?
With each other. Let's get some sense of proportion.
Oh, don't talk about proportion. There isn't any time. If you're not taking the 5:30, call me up. Goodbye.
Goodbye. I'll make the 5:30, all right. Time.
Sir, thank you.
Why, hello, Charlie.
Hello, Roger. Lousy morning.
The radio says it'll clear up by noon. Hope so. Hey, listen, Charlie, will you have any time in your hands today?
Not much. How about lunch?
Oh, I can't make it. I have a date with Tony at the University Club. After that, Mates is coming in. But we've got to check up on that Catlin thing before we meet with the attorney.
We can go over to the train if you want to. I've got the papers here.
Boy, I simply can't. Tony wants me, saving me a seat.
There's a lot more to banking than you think, isn't there? It's an art, isn't it?
Charles, you're always so subtle in the morning. Well, I'll see you in the studio.
All right. Don't mix your colors wrong, Roger. Roger. Roger doesn't answer. He's already bounding up the steps of the third coach. He's always been quick on his feet, and this sort of thing's been going on long enough for me to understand all the shades of me. I'd give odds that Tony Burton coming down from Stanford hadn't asked Roger to sit with him. And I'm not even completely sure that Tony Burton asked Roger to lunch at the University Club. Though Tony tries to lunch there when he can on Tuesdays. Find a seat by a window and open the Times to the financial page. In this corner, weighing 172, wearing rimless glasses and a blue Brooks Brothers pinstripe number, and carrying a degree from the Harvard Graduate School of Business Administration, Roger Blakesley. My fellow assistant vice president in the trust department and my mortal competition. We both worked almost everywhere in the bank. Very bright boys, both of us. But I just shade Roger, and Tony Burton undoubtedly knows it. I guess. I hope. Tony Burton. Ah, it was a great day for the Charles Rays back there just before Pearl Harbor when he made the great suggestion.
Look here, fella. Why not cut out this sir business? Why not just call me Tony?
Great joy and relief. Mostly relief. And after only 11 years in the bank, too. I could hardly wait to tell Nancy.
Darling, we ought to have a drink of something, shouldn't we? I knew it would happen sometime. Oh, I'm pretty proud of you, Charlie.
A week later, we found out that Mr. Burton had also asked Roger Blakesley to call him Tony. And we never did find out which one of us he'd asked first. Bubble, what's on the agenda?
Nothing on your calendar before the meeting, but Mrs. Whittaker has just called you.
All right. Get her for me in 5 minutes.
Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning, Tony.
I didn't see you on the train.
I didn't see you either. Mrs. Whittaker is after me.
Well, as long as she's after you and not me. We'll see you at dinner Friday, won't we?
You can count on it, absolutely.
Yeah, I suppose we can, Charlie. You boys getting together at 11, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
I'll be there.
Did he just weigh every word the way I did? Why should he? But maybe it was there between the lines and I muffed it. No. Just a bland routine conversation. Friendly, all right, and nothing more. What else could it be but Roger's death right beside mine? Forget it.
Mrs. Whittaker's on the telephone now.
Good morning, Mrs. Whittaker. This is Mr. Gray.
Oh, Mr. Gray. It's so nice to hear your voice. Stuart and I are so dreadfully worried, Mr. Gray.
Why, I'm sorry. What have you to be worried about?
Well, we have to sell something, Mr. Gray, and right away. We literally haven't got a cent of money. We simply don't know what to sell. Everything shows a profit.
Well, most of our friends like it better that way. You see, you have a number of short-term governments.
Oh, Mr. Whittaker doesn't want to sell those. His father always said, you mustn't be a bear on the United States. He said we must back up the government no matter what it does. I believe that, don't you?
Well, I wouldn't say it would be disloyal to sell. Short-term governments are about the same as cash.
Well, suppose we try to think of something else.
Yes. I'd better get a picture of the whole situation. If you're not well enough to come in yourself, I could send Mr. Joyce over to see you.
I don't think Mr. Joyce has the experience, do you? And, what's his name? The one Mr. Burton turned me over to last time when you were out. He was indefinite, too. And besides, I thought he was a little chef. Oh, that round-faced pussycat man with the glasses.
You don't mean Mr. Blakesley, do you?
Yeah, that's it, Mr. Blakesley.
Why, I know him pretty well. I wouldn't say he was a pussycat.
It's a compliment to you, Mr. Gray, that Stuart and I both want you to help us. And we simply have to find $100,000 somewhere.
All right. I'll see you at 5, Mrs. Whittaker.
Goodbye, Mr. Gray.
Mr. Gray, there's a gentleman to see you.
Oh, good morning.
Well, if it isn't Charlie Gray. Charlie, don't you remember me at all? Come on, I could tell you anywhere. The child is father to the man.
Did I know you when I was a child?
No, you didn't. You knew me when I was 32 and you were 22. Listen, Charlie, I'm Malcolm Bryant.
Malcolm? Well, I'll be a son of a gun.
You're looking fine here.
Sit down.
Yeah, I just dropped in to cash a government check, and the cashier asked if anybody could identify me. I looked around, and there you were.
Oh, let me have it. I'll initial it. Joe,
yes?
Will you get this cash, please?
Right away, sir.
Well. How's Jessica?
I don't know. I haven't seen her for quite a while.
What? Didn't you marry Jessica?
No.
Well, how's Clyde?
I don't know, Malcolm.
Aren't your family still living there?
Well, my father's dead, and my mother's living with Dorothea in Kansas City.
Oh, so Dorothea's married.
She married a man named Elbridge Stern, a metallurgist. He's in Kansas City.
Oh, yes, Elbridge. What about the old house?
I guess it's still there. We sold it. I haven't been there for a very long time.
Massachusetts ghost town. A vital sort of ghost town. That's the way I described it in the introduction.
Introduction?
Haven't you seen my book on Clyde?
No.
It's the best thing the Foundation ever got out. I'll give you one.
Why, thanks, Malcolm. What's it called?
Yankee Persepolis. That's what I call Clyde.
Well, why Persepolis?
Well, that's where the Persians worship memories. I stopped off there in 35 on my way to India. I was studying some dog worshippers there.
So you're still on primitive man.
Yes, but don't forget, all man is primitive. You ought to know that. You're primitive.
Yes, I suppose I am.
So is Clyde. Primitive like any other social structure.
Here's your cash, Mr. Gray.
Thank you, Joe. Yes, Miss Marble?
It's 11 o'clock, Mr. Gray.
Well, thanks. Here's your wampum, Malcolm. Oh. You'd better count it.
Well, it's only paper and has less intrinsic value than shell money. It's symbolism. Where are you going?
I have to go to a meeting.
Well, how about lunch? Come on over to the Harvard Club.
Miss Marble, have I a luncheon engagement?
Why, no, not today, Mr. Gray.
I'll see you there then at 12:30. Goodbye, Charlie.
Ready to go down for the meeting, Charlie?
Just let me get these papers away, Roger.
Matter of the Eastern Loan, gentlemen. Are there further questions or suggestions?
Why didn't he go to his own bank? Not that it's any of my business.
May I say something on that, Tony?
Why, go right ahead, Roger.
It's because I met him first, Charles, and I'm selling him on the personal service of a small bank. I met him playing golf. I've seen quite a good deal of Godfrey Easton. He's a friend of Sam Summerby. You know him, Tony, Sam Summerby from Baltimore.
You made a good point there, Roger. A very good point, old boy. Maybe it's my imagination. Maybe I'm getting as sensitive as the knock-kneed maiden, but it seems they're all watching Roger and me. He didn't have to say it, but nobody's missed it that he's promoted a nice piece of business with his privatism, which is more than I've done lately. And he did it because he gets around and sweetens contacts and plays golf with people like Samuel Summerby. And nobody here has missed that Roger is good. He said it's too bad Charlie plays such a rotten game of golf. They're waiting. I've got to say something.
Are you on a first-name basis with him, Roger?
Well, of course I am. I've known Godfrey Easton for a year. Everybody at the club knows Godfrey.
Well, I rather like him myself. He's breezy, but he has an agreeable personality. But Charles has put the finger on it. Why should he come around to us?
Because he liked us, Tony. He told me he liked you very much personally.
Why shouldn't he? I'd love Tony myself if he'd lend me $300,000. That's the way it is. Love and money.
You're so right, Charlie.
As a matter of fact, gentlemen, Easton's putting up enough collateral. There's only one security I question. Now, here's an unlisted company from a place called Clyde, Massachusetts, the Nickerson Cordage Company. But has anyone ever heard of the Nickerson Cordage Company? Oh, wait a minute. Clyde, let's see. Let's see, Charles, don't you come from a place called Clyde?
Yes, sir. I was born there, but I haven't been there in quite a while.
Well, what about the Nickerson Cordage Company?
They used to make rope and twine and fishnets. I didn't know the firm was incorporated. Must have grown.
Well, if Godfrey Easton has money in it, it must be good.
Well, gentlemen, we'll leave this for now. It's getting on toward lunchtime.
What am I doing in this conference room? How did I get here? Do I really want to be here? I guess we're all here by some sort of accident because banking is dignified and fashionable, and there isn't much else but business when you finish college. 12:10. Out of here soon, and that's a break. Roger's getting a little difficult. Both of us assistant VPs and showing off before the bank officials like college boys bucking for manager of some team. Doing it in a nice way, of course. Both of us justifying. It's warfare every minute. Maybe I'd better join the bunch around Tony Burton and show some eagerness and zeal. Not too much. Just the right touch of each.
Well, you can't always tell beforehand. It may sound a little strange, but when I was a sophomore at Yale, I studied Greek. And, gentlemen, I can tell you that Greek verbs have taught me more about corporate figures than anything else I ever learned at Yale.
It's pretty clear, as you've often said, Tony. Everything fits into banking somewhere.
Exactly, Charles. Everything. Banking, basically, is only knowing how to use extraneous knowledge, where it deals with all the most fundamental hopes and aspirations of human beings. In fact, I don't like... Honestly, I don't. I don't like to think of banking as a business or even as a profession, but as an art. The last of the arts, perhaps, but the oldest of the professions. Let's get some lunch, gentlemen.
Sorry to keep you waiting, Charlie. Let's go in the dining room and have some lunch. Ah, I see you've been looking over my opus. Yeah,
I was just glancing through it while you were on the phone. It's funny, I never heard of it before.
Oh, well, it's a professional sort of book. Everybody has to publish something.
It has a lot of facts. Mm. But it doesn't sound much like Clyde.
Oh, well, good Lord. It isn't meant to be Clyde. It's only meant to represent a characteristic social unit. Charlie, let's not wait on ourselves. Let's get the table at the end.
All right, Malcolm, you're paying for it. I can't. I'm a likable Dartmouth
boy. So you read that piece, did you?
Hmm? I just glanced at it. There wasn't much time.
Oh. Well, what do you have? Order anything you like.
Oh, the regular lunch is fine, thanks. I haven't much time.
That book. I thought everything was pretty well scrambled in it, but you picked yourself out, didn't you?
Yes. The Smith family.
I'm afraid it made you sore. Well, you get it out of your head that it's personal.
I wouldn't say I was sore, but of course it's personal, and I can't say I like the idea.
What idea?
Well, you know, you might have put our family in the middle upper classification instead of the lower upper. Did you ever get married? You were always talking about marriage.
Oh, never mind it. Women always forget me when I go away. What happened about you and Jessica?
Never mind it now.
All right. And what's happened to you since? I mean, since I used to know you.
Well, that's quite an order. Why do you want to know?
Because I always liked you, Charlie. And I'm interested in people, academically.
That's just it. Academically. You want to fill in the end of a case history about likable Tom Smith of Dartmouth. I don't mind. I rather like being part of a case history.
You've got a tough mind, Charlie.
I have to have one. I've cultivated it, I suppose. There are a lot of tough minds in New York.
No. You haven't cultivated it. You've always had a tough mind, Charlie, and a sensitive disposition. Clyde was full of minds like that.
Oh, never mind Clyde. Go ahead and ask me some questions.
All right. Never mind Clyde. Well, what have you been doing, Charlie?
Well, in 30, I got a job in the statistical department of the Stuyvesant, and I did it well enough, so I held it through the Depression. Married a girl who worked downtown in a law office. They have two children. We built a house in Connecticut that I'm still paying for. And now there's a vice presidential vacancy at the bank. It rests between me and another man who has a tough mind, too. That's about all I've been doing.
Well, of course, you haven't filled in many details. For instance, do you love your wife?
I thought you'd ask that. And the answer is yes, I love my wife. I love my home and my children.
Yeah, I thought you would. You're an essentially monogamous type. Ah, so you've been to the war.
Oh, yes. I've forgotten about the button.
Yes, I was in two. OSS.
I was with the 8th Air Force. Only good for staff work.
And now that you're back, don't you ever feel restless?
No. I'm not restless. I didn't like the Army. Most civilians don't.
Well, let's put it another way. Don't you ever get to wondering what everything is about, whether everything is worthwhile?
It's a little tough to answer that one. I'm just Tom Smith from Dartmouth trying to get along. You know, someday you ought to take a trip to the USA and do a study on the race of bankers.
That's not a bad idea at all. What are they like?
Well, my father used to say that it was as easy for him to spot a banker as a clergyman. They have a slightly antiseptic, sanctimonious look, he said. And yet they don't look like lawyers.
And what do you say?
Well, I can only speak about the employees of the Stuyvesant. We're all specialists in understanding rich clients. We know all the pains and drawbacks of being rich, although we're not rich men ourselves.
Let's hear some more.
You find yourself spending the working day discussing investments of hundreds of thousands of dollars, only to get home yourself and worry because the butcher bill is up $20 over the last one and whether you can afford to have your kids' teeth straightened. In time, this gives you a split personality. In time, you can't ever change from being a banker. Stuyvesant's president likes to talk about the banker's responsibility to society. Personally, I've never felt like a social worker, but I do feel that responsibility. Well, it's 2:15. I've got to go now.
Oh, no, not yet. We've only just begun to talk, sir.
I wish you hadn't made me talk about myself all the time.
Charlie, you've got a lot of guts.
How do you mean, guts?
Saying what you do, doing what you do. It takes guts to be your type these days. Goodbye, Charlie. Good luck.
Hollywood, the NBC University Theater, is bringing you Kent Smith in a radio version of J.P. Marquand's Point of No Return. If you are interested in supplementing your enjoyment of these NBC University Theater productions with home study under college supervision, be sure to listen to the announcement at the end of this program. And now, our intermission commentator, the editor of the Atlantic Monthly, Mr. Edward Weeks.
I think John Marquand is a novelist who gets better with every book. In 1943, Secretary Stimson sent Mr. Marquand on a series of missions to Africa and Italy. In 1945, he went out again as a war correspondent in the Pacific. He lived aboard some of our big carriers. He flew a good many thousand miles to report on the islands which we'd liberated from the Japs. I mention this war experience of John Marquand's because of its bearing on his new novel, Point of No Return. In his bull sessions with the officers and men in Europe and in the South Pacific, Marquand observed the impact of the war on men of middle age, men only a little younger than himself. Our army was made up of civilians, and every one of us know of married men who have come back from the war, intent on finding something better, something bigger to do than they were doing before they went into uniform. That's the theme which Marquand is revealing to you in Point of No Return. Charles Gray, the hero of Point of No Return, is in his early 40s, working in a New York bank. At his age, he didn't have to go into the army. His wife thought he was a fool to sign up. She thought he'd lose his chance to be the head of the bank. But Charles went out. He saw action with the Army Air Force in Africa and Italy. And now, as the story opens in the year 1947, Charles is back in the bank, but much more quizzical about himself and his job. The war, you see, has given him a fresh hold on himself and a fresh, disquieting slant on his old values. Now watch the skill with which Marquand brings his hero, Charles Gray, to the point of decision, the point of no return. The story begins on a Tuesday in April, and all that day, we see Charles going through his human, rather exasperating routine at the bank. We meet Charles as he goes to work that Tuesday morning. And then on Friday, he and Nancy, his wife, are to dine with the president of the bank, and Charles knows that he's to learn his fate that evening, whether or not he's to be made the vice president. Tuesday to Friday, just 4 days in the life of a middle-aged banker. Yet in that time, Charles has grown deeply into your affections. You see him against the ironical background of the bank. You see him at the country club dance. You see him squabbling with his wife. You see him at the dinner party. And you see him alone. I think it's one of the best stories of the wear and tear of being on a payroll and of trying to get ahead that I've ever read. I think the characterization of Charles is lifelike and endearing and identifiable. I know a good many veterans who feel the way Charles does. And I think the three women in the book, Nancy, the girl he married, Jessica, the girl he should have married, and Mrs. Burton, that dreadful dinner party at Mrs. Burton, I think those three women you won't soon forget.
Thank you, Mr. Weeks. Our radio version of Point of No Return, starring Kent Smith, will continue from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
Seeley?
The matter that Mr. Burton asked you yesterday to handle. Oh. He's not back from lunch.
Which makes it natural to Mr. Seeley. We hope that I do the dusty work.
Here's the memorandum.
Thank you. Bert J. Seelig is part owner of the Teddy Club and the La Casita Nightclub. Owns real estate at Palm Springs, also Miami. He was indicted for income tax fraud, but indictment was quashed. Well, what's the use of going on? It's all decided. It could have been handled by letter, but Tony Burton disapproves of anything so permanent. Tony Burton approves, and Tony Burton disapproves. A jaunty, white-haired guard at a roll-top desk, indefinite about yes or no, very positive about maybe.
Excuse me, Mr. Gray.
It's all right, Joe.
Mr. Seelig, this is I, Mr. Gray. He will take care of you.
I'm happy to meet you, Mr. Gray.
Mr. Burton asked me to see you. I have all the details. Won't you sit down, Mr. Seelig?
Ah, nice little place you have here. Very nice.
It's just a small bank.
Well, that's what draws me to it, Mr. Gray. I know some lovely people banking here, some of my best friends. Well, I suppose you've looked me over. I hope I've passed through the lineup by now. I'm used to being looked over in my position.
Anyone in business gets looked over.
That's right. Now, what's the story? Do you people want my account or don't you?
Well, our officers have been over the question very carefully. We would value your account in a great many ways, Mr. Seeley. But we really feel you'll be better off in another bank. I hope you'll understand, Mr. Seeley, sorry as we are to turn away profitable business. Mr. Burton asked me to tell you personally that this is a purely business decision.
So the answer is no, is it?
I'm afraid so. We're very sorry.
So I'm not a nice enough guy to play with your crowd. Is that it?
There's nothing personal intended. We often find the needs of some depositors are better filled by other banks.
I'm not used to being given the runaround. Why didn't they say that the first time I came in?
I'm sorry you put it that way. Mr. Burton was impressed by your references.
So you're fronting for the crowd, are you? How much did they pay you? $10,000 a year? Guys like you fascinate me. How would you like $25,000 a year?
What for?
For what you're doing here. Fronting for the crowd.
Thanks. I'm afraid I couldn't use it. But I appreciate your acting.
You guys fascinate me. Money everywhere, you don't want money.
Maybe we get too used to it. Maybe we get tired of seeing so much of it around.
Well, that's just what fascinates me. All of it around, and you don't take it. No. No hard feelings?
Oh, no. Not at all. We're very sorry, Mr. Seeley.
Yeah, that takes poise. I wouldn't have the poise.
I wouldn't call it poise. I'd call it temperament and timidity. Goodbye. We're sorry, Mr. Seeley.
How was it, Charlie?
A perfect gentleman, Roger. He asked me if I was fronting for the crowd.
Oh, Charlie, is Seeley called?
Oh, yes, Tony. He's just left.
Well, I'm glad I missed him. How'd he take it?
His feelings were hurt. But then, mine would have been, too.
Oh, there aren't any complications, then?
No, Tony, I don't think so.
Well, this sort of thing always worries
me. Oh, Mr. Burton.
Yes?
Have you, got time to see me for a minute?
Yes, if it's only for a minute, Roger.
Easy now. Stop sweating inside. Keep yourself blank and busy. But it might have implications. Why should Roger ask to see him now? Why didn't he just go over to his desk without any appointment? We always do. He wants to see Tony privately. Maybe Roger's getting tired of waiting, too. How many times have I dreamed of doing it in the last few weeks? So step right over and ask right out, how about the vice presidency? And on good grounds, too. This sort of waiting, Tony, is bad for general morale. All right, so he does it. What's the point of getting my stomach all knotted and hanging by my fingernails? What use is it? But what else? Nothing. No way to stop it. It might be different if Tony knew somebody else wanted me for the same salary. Instead, he knows the times are tight and uncertain. And Tony's stalling. 6 months now. And Tony's mulling and weighing and balancing, vacillating.
Speak to him, Charles. Ask Tony the score.
Oh, poor Nancy. That would tear it, but good. Still, it's something to think about. To walk right over and be upright, downright, straightforward. Listen, Tony. Let's face the facts. Maybe you're removed from office politics, but everybody here in the bank knows you're considering proposing either Roger Blakesley or me for this vice presidency. They're making bets on it in the washroom. It isn't dignified. We're both making monkeys of ourselves, running around and polishing apples. You know everything about me, Tony. I've been around here long enough. I know it's hard to step on somebody's face, but this thing's been going on for months, and I'm tired of staying awake at night. And Nancy's getting tired, too. How about it, Tony? Yes?
Mr. Gray. Mr. Burton wants to know if you can see him for a moment.
What? Oh, yes. I'll be right over.
Well, sit down, Charlie. Have a cigarette and relax.
Well, what's on your mind, Tony? Say, that's a handsome cigarette case. To America's most representative daddy, Gladys Olivia Babs.
The girls gave it to me on Father's Day. I didn't know I was a representative dad.
I didn't know you were either. But it must be nice to know.
Well, I don't like being representative of anything.
Sitting where you are, you've got to represent.
Well, I was thinking the other day that you're pretty representative yourself, Charlie.
Well, I hope I am, Tony. I try to be in business hours.
Hmm. Well, speaking of representatives, how did you represent things to Seeley?
I told him he'd be happier elsewhere.
Why didn't you tell him we'd have room for him in the quite near future?
Because he wouldn't have believed it.
Well, he has a lot of good connections. That's the trouble with life these days. There's no pattern. You don't know where you're at anymore. My girls keep going to La Casita, but we can't handle Seeley's account. Oh, well, let's forget it, Charlie. There's one other thing.
Yes, sir?
About the loan.
Oh, which loan, sir?
Oh, the one we were discussing this morning. That cordage company. You said you were born up there. What's the name of the place?
Oh, you mean Clyde?
Yes, that's it. Clyde. Now, somebody ought to see that company, and it just occurred to me, since you lived up there and know the background, you'd better go up for a day or two and look things over. Just quietly. Oh, I envy you getting away for a while. You're looking a little tired, Charles.
Do you mind if I ask you a question, Tony?
Why, no. Of course not, John.
Did you think up this idea yourself?
Why, no. Now that you mentioned it, it wasn't entirely my idea. I suppose Roger ought to go. It's his responsibility, but he doesn't know Clyde. Let's see. You'll be back by Friday, won't you? Remember, you're coming to dinner on Friday.
I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Yeah. Well, relax and have a good time, Charlie. Well,
that's the second time you've told me to relax.
Well, then do it. I'll see you Friday. Just you and Nancy are coming. Yeah, you and I'll have a good long talk about the whole situation here on Friday.
Hello, Cyril.
Charles.
Mind if I cut in? I could take Nancy off your hands.
Give him the devil for being late, Nancy. Have fun, Charles.
Thank heavens you've come. Been dancing with him for ages. Is there any news?
Nothing much. I can't talk about it here, Nancy.
Well, what have you been doing all day?
I was stuck in the Whittaker's apartment.
Oh, Whittaker's. Did anything else happen? Did you say anything to Tony Britton?
No, not exactly.
How do you mean, not exactly?
Just that, not exactly.
Roger Blakesley's here tonight. Have you seen him?
Not yet, but I've seen him all day.
He looks exuberant.
Oh, does he?
You look a little tired, darling.
Well, I am tired.
Did the children get you your supper?
Yes. Thanks for leaving the car.
Charlie.
Yes?
Before we go, be sure to dance with Molly Blakesley.
Aye, aye, sir.
Well, to answer you truthfully, Molly, no, I don't know what Roger was saying the other night.
Roger was saying how fond everyone is of you at the bank. And he was saying how wonderful it was that we were all such good friends. And he hoped we always would stay friends, no matter what happens at the bank. You know what I mean. Oh, it's so embarrassing, isn't it?
Well, it needn't be embarrassing, Molly. Roger and I are grown up.
You know, I think the war did you a lot of good, Charlie. Roger thinks so, too. I think it was pretty splendid of you, with a wife and two children, to give up everything and go to war. Roger thinks so, too.
It was just a sort of compulsion. It wasn't wise. And I wasn't much use when I got there.
May I sit in?
Well, see you later, Charlie. Perhaps we can do something Sunday. Roger would love it if he could. Charlie, it's a lovely house. Our house.
Yes. It's a swell house.
Oh, I know. It's got odds about it. But don't forget one thing. You and I did it by ourselves, without any so-and-so to help us. I suppose you think it's a corny thing to say, but that's why it's a nice house. Now, come in. see what a nice job they did waxing the living room floor. We ought to use this room more, shouldn't we? I wonder why we don't.
That's easy. Because we're afraid of it.
Well, let's not be afraid of it. Charlie, take off your coat. Sit down on the sofa. I'll get rid of my slippers. There. Now, don't say we're afraid of this room. I don't like it.
Why not?
Because I don't like being afraid. I don't mean that I'm afraid of anything. I only mean I don't like the idea. You know what I mean.
Nance, we didn't used to be afraid.
Oh, are you afraid too? Well, you might have told me.
It's all relative.
What's relative?
The more you get, the more afraid you get. That's all I mean. Maybe fear's what makes the world go round.
Not love. I used to hear that it was love.
Everyone's afraid of something. Afraid of living. Afraid of dying. Maybe it's better than being afraid of losing money. That's what the boys are afraid of downtown. Do you know what I wish? I wish we weren't always being pushed around. I'd like for once in my life to be able to tell someone where to go.
Darling, basically, you have the most extensive taste. You better just tell me where to go and let it go at that.
But it isn't the same thing, is it?
Maybe not. But I'm awfully glad we're afraid of the same thing. It's healthy to have things in common. I'm awfully glad we're in the same boat, darling.
That's what Roger said tonight. Oh, wait, there's something else I've got to tell you. I'm taking the plane to Boston first thing in the morning. I'm going up to Clyde for a day or two in business for the bank.
Oh, how did Clyde get into it?
Why do you always get edgy whenever I mention Clyde?
Well, you know very well why. Clyde makes you difficult. It's a queer place, full of ingrown people. You say so yourself.
I can't help it if I was brought up there, and I didn't ask to go up there now.
Roger will make time at the bank while you're away.
I don't think it'll make much difference. I think Tony Burton's about made up his mind which of us he wants.
Well, then, for heaven's sake, why doesn't he tell you instead of letting us
go? Because perhaps he doesn't like to do it. Tony's quite a nice guy, as far as anyone like him could be nice. I think we'll get the news Friday when we go there to dinner. He almost said so. Besides, maybe it's just as well for me to be away. Tony knows Roger worked it, at least I think he knows. Maybe Roger will try a little too much. Tony's rather bright sometimes.
He picks out that darn fool, he isn't too bright.
I only said that he's pretty bright sometimes.
If you'd only get mad.
You would just say it's a luxury. There's no use getting mad at a system. We're part of a system where there's always someone waiting to kick you in the teeth in a nice way.
What'll you do if he takes Roger?
Nance, let's not think about it now.
Why not? Let's dig in. It has a nice, ironic flavor. After years of proud work, you become specialized. You become used to the ways of one organization. You become too old to start again in a new one. You've seen plenty of men your age looking for a job. There. I haven't solved anything, but at least I've said it.
Sure. Why not?
Well, I guess we'd better go to bed.
You go ahead. I'll be up in a little while. Good night, Nance. Don't, Nance. The show isn't over.
I'm sorry, darling. I'm all right now. You always hate having me cry, don't you?
Yes.
Are you sorry you married me?
Of course not.
You sorry we have the children?
No, of course I'm not.
They were my idea more than yours. Are you sorry we built the house?
Listen, Nance, it happened like the children. Now go on.
What are you going to do, just sit here and worry? Because if you are, we might as well do it together.
I'm going to read. I'm pretty well worried out tonight. Good night, Nance. I'll be in the library.
Don't be long. Won't be able to get to sleep till you come up.
Let's see. Where's that book? Yankee Persepolis, a social study by Malcolm Bryant. A final and considered summation of a study made some years ago of a typical New England town, its culture, and its social implications. Typical of a lower upper family are the Henry Smiths, father, mother, son, and daughter. Like other lower upper families, they dwell on a side street, yet are received on Mason Street. Mr. Smith, with investment interests in Boston. Mr. Smith, alias John Gray, father of Tom Smith, alias me. Father, the big-time stock market operator at the end. And on his way to a million and finally quitting. But that was October, the 29. And he was just a week too late in getting out. I found him asleep forever. In the Bible and a bottle of sleeping pills in the chair by his bed. Father, I love. Father, I never wanted to be like. And yet, I am.
You can't beat the system, Charlie.
What system, Father?
One under which we live, the order. There's always some sort of order, and there's always a bundle of hay out ahead for any ass that wants to get on. And they make it look like a very pleasant bundle.
Who are they?
Well, that's an intelligent question, even for a recent Dartmouth graduate. They are the people who own the hay. They're the people who run the system. They tell you there's plenty of hay for anyone who can get it. But the main thing, Charlie, is they don't really want you to get it. Might be some of their hay. If I were you, I wouldn't try too hard for the hay. You might be disappointed, Charlie.
You were right, old man. I didn't have what it took to beat the system. That said, there's a grand canyon between Spruce Street and Johnson Street. We should have remembered we were Spruce Street, and I should have remembered Jessica Lovell and her father were Johnson Streeters. Why do I think of it now? Why can I still be hurt by Jessica's father?
I thought this over carefully, Charles. I've been over it thoroughly with Jessica. We've been most unhappy. It's an impossible situation, Charles. We must end it. It can't go on.
And here I am in Clyde again, walking the streets in the rain, reviving old ghosts, and yet enjoying their presence.
You've got to beat the system, Charlie. The harder you pursue happiness, the less liberty you have. If you pursue it hard enough, this might ruin you.
I never did beat the system called Johnson Street. Never did catch up with the happiness called Jessica Lovell. The old small-town story. The life of a lad trying to climb higher and being snapped down nicely. I got up off the canvas, hurt and ambitious, and left Clyde to beat the system.
It was all very good for you. It's made you into a very nice guy. Maybe it's made you too nice.
And now I'm back here in Clyde, 17 years later, still trying to move from lower upper. But now there's no stopping and no turning back. I'm the airplane pilot on a long flight, steadily approaching the point where it takes more gas to get back than to go on to my destination. Distant as it is and stormy, I've passed my point of no return.
Well, tell me about it, Charlie. What was it like back in Clyde? Was it good?
It was quite an experience. Jackie Mason's got everything now.
Who?
Jackie Mason. I told you about him. He used to live next door to us.
Oh, yes, yes, of course. What about him?
Well, he's a director of the Dock Street Savings Bank, a trustee of the library, and he's in the Tuesday Club. And he's going to marry Jessica Lovell.
Well, you could have done all that, too.
I'm glad I didn't. But at the same time, he hasn't got anything. That's what I'm trying to say.
Who hasn't got anything?
Jackie Mason.
Oh, to the devil with Jackie Mason. He hasn't made a touchdown.
All right. Never mind, Intensive.
I'm sorry, Charlie. I just can't concentrate. Let's stop trying to talk as though we both weren't thinking about the same thing.
Yes, I know.
Charlie, what's the matter?
Oh, Lord. I wish everything weren't so contrived.
Contrived? What do you mean, contrived?
Just that. The bank president and the big job and what will happen to Junior and whether a boiled shirt will help. The values of it are childish. It hasn't any values at all. Nance, don't be so tense. This isn't as important as all that. I've done everything I can. Now, let's change the subject.
You're acting licked already. I hate it when you act that way.
All right. Maybe I am licked, and maybe I don't give a rap. Roger Blakesley's pretty fast on his feet. Faster than I am.
Charlie, if... what are you going to do? Haven't you even thought what you're going to do if Roger...
I'm sick of thinking.
It isn't fair. It isn't fair. Oh,
never mind, Nance. Never mind. It doesn't matter if we're late.
I'm all right now. I didn't mean to let you down.
You haven't let me down.
I'm all right now. We'd better be on time at the Burtons. Don't look at me, Charlie. Don't say anything. And darn everybody.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Perhaps I'm being cryptic now, Althea, but all I'm saying to you and Nancy and Charlie is that I wish we might all be friends.
Well, of course. We'll always be friends, Tony.
I really hope we can be, in spite of anything that may happen in the future. That's all I'm trying to say. Now, if you girls will excuse us, I'm going to take Charlie into the library. Charlie and I want to have a little talk, but we'll be back as soon as we can.
Now, don't stay too long and don't get too interested.
Come along, Charlie.
Friends. Ever since we came in, he's been harping on me. The needle's all the way in now. This is the bad news. It's all ending now in this little walk across the hall. I can sell the house. Real estate's still high. Cost of money enough to educate Bill. But I'll again be where I am. I'll have some commercial value as an educated wheel horse. And I'm nice to know my place. But I'll never have to try so hard again. It's over. Thank God. It's over.
This friendship in business. It's always bothered me. They shouldn't be mixed together.
Well, they don't mix together. Don't try to make them, Tony.
And yet they must mix. None of us can help it, Charlie. If you see somebody every day, if you have any human instincts at all, you get interested in him. Now, take Blakesley. What do you think of him, Charlie?
What do you want me to think?
Well, it isn't what I want. You and I are alone here. You don't have to be so careful. I want your opinion. Do you like him or don't you?
All right. As long as it doesn't matter anymore, Tony. He's conscientious, energetic, and well-trained. But I don't like him much. Why should I?
Well, I rather like him. He's been on my conscience lately. He's so very anxious, so very much on his toes. He's always in there, trying.
What else do you expect? I've been trying pretty hard myself.
Yes, but not in the same way, Charlie. You're subtler. You've developed. You've matured.
Thanks, but I wouldn't say I've been very subtle.
Of course, I'm out of touch with things, being where I am, but... Well, it seems to me that Roger's got some idea we're considering him for the vice presidency. Do you know anything about this?
Lord. Oh, good Lord. Well, what did you think Roger was considering?
Well, I didn't give it much thought until about 10 days ago. I'm glad it amuses you. It doesn't amuse me. When anyone gets ideas like that, it's a problem what to do with him later. He was useful while you were away, but he's not the right material. It had never occurred to me you'd have any doubts about it. Your name's coming up before the directors on Monday. Now, what do you think we'd better do about Blakesley?
Well, you'd better tell him something, Tony, instead of teasing him to death.
Oh, I'm sorry about the whole thing. Perhaps he'd better resign. That was all I meant in the dining room. Now that we'll be working together more closely, Charlie, I hope that we'll always be friends. We'd better join the girls. Don't suppose this comes as any great surprise, Nancy?
No, I can't say I'm surprised. But it's nice to know definitely.
Tony.
As long as we're all in the family. I was just telling Charlie that I've been worried about Roger Blakesley. Do you suppose he really may have thought he was being considered?
Well, now that you mention it, I think perhaps he did. A little.
Here it is, Charlie.
You're a vice president now. What you dreamed of long ago. And yet, it's a strangely hollow climax. I suppose it was written in the stars, and I couldn't have changed a line of it being what I am. At least Nancy will be pleased. We'll sell the house at Sycamore Park and get a larger place, turn in the Buick for a new one. The children will get their sailboat. No. May not be what you dreamed of, Charlie, back in the Clyde of your father and Jessica Lovell. But it has its compensations.
Oh, Charlie.
Oh, I'm sorry. What were you saying, Tony?
I said I don't think I've ever seen you smoke a cigar before.
I don't often, but I rather feel like it tonight.
You have been listening to Points of No Return, an NBC University Theater production of the novel by J.P. Marquand, starring Kent Smith. If you wish to expand your knowledge and appreciation of literature, we suggest that you write to the NBC University Theater in care of the University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky, the University of Tulsa, Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Kansas State Teachers College, Pittsburgh, Kansas. Next week, be with us again at the NBC University Theater for a dramatization of one of the richest flavored books of our time. Richard Llewellyn's How Green Was My Valley, starring Donald Crisp. And the following week, an engaging period piece, F. Scott Fitzgerald's first novel, This Side of Paradise, starring Guy Madison. Point of No Return was prepared for radio by Milton Wayne, starred as Charles Gray, Kent Smith, who will soon be co-starred with Helen Hayes in Good Housekeeping for the Theater Guild. Our cast included Lynn Whitney, Frank Gerstle, Ted Von Eltz, John Daner, Larry Dobkin, William Lally, Lois Corbett, Stephen Chase, Margaret Brayton, your announcer, Don Stanley. Our intermission commentator was Edward Weeks, whose commentary was recorded. The prologue to the broadcast was from Choruses from the Rock by T.S. Eliot. The original music score was composed and conducted by Dr. Albert Harris. The director of the NBC University Theater is Andrew C. Love. This program came to you from Hollywood. This is NBC, the national broadcasting company.